America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. It's been said that education is the next frontier for the civil rights movement. Without a good head start and a school system able to meet the unique needs of our students, it is they and we who will fail. As the president says repeatedly, quoting his wife, the society that out-educates us will win the future. So we can't afford to fail. But radical changes will be required to reform our schools. We discuss what those might look like today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Tressa Pankovitz, and she's the co-director of Reinventing America's Schools with the Progressive Policy Institute. And we'll talk about your initiative in general in just a moment. But I've got to ask you, America's schools, when we look at reinvention, you know, I've heard this before, Tressa, I've got to tell you. In fact, I was the assistant to the Commissioner of Education here in my home state of Connecticut for a short period of time. And we thought we were reforming the entire system in the state. We had this motto, equity and excellence. And we began to try to deal with the financing of various rich and poor communities. We began to look at curriculum in a serious way. I guess I'm wondering today, what does reform look like and what's most in need of reform?
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here. If I had the answer to that question, we probably wouldn't be talking today. Reform looks like a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But I think if you look at it through an equity lens, what is most in need of reform is ensuring that we are offering equal opportunity to all. And we know that our education system does not look like that today. And in fact, probably has never looked like that.
Well, I remember about a year and a half, 2 years ago, I did a podcast with a gentleman from Stanford, and Stanford and Harvard had done some research looking at about 50 years of effort that dealt with equity and excellence, and they found that the results weren't terribly different from a prior era to the era of reform. Why was that?
I think you're referring to Stanford University's research on educational outcomes, which we call CREDO for shorthand, and it is really the gold standard of research in this area, and they've done some really great studies. But I think the question is not just about reform, but about reshaping and reinventing. If we were creating an education system from scratch today in this country, I think you need to ask yourself, would it look like a large bureaucratic standardized system in this era where everyone has a device? Not everyone, but many people have devices and all people need them. Would it be limited to roughly eight and a half months out of the year? Would it be limited to maybe 6-7 hours a day? And would all children be being taught the same thing in the same way, which is the norm in traditional school districts? I don't think that we would create an education system from scratch today that looks like what we have now. And in fact, a recent report by the Hunt Institute found that overwhelmingly, the most important thing to parents was personalized learning. And I think this comes out of the pandemic shutdowns, where parents were able to witness for the first time in real time their students as students. They had a window into a classroom that they had never had before, and they were able to witness their children being engaged or bored or intimidated or self-confident. And I think that parents are taking away that the reforms we need now are to address the fact that children do not learn the same. Some come to school with more maturity than others. Some are able to sit still for longer periods of time. We know that some kids are very artistic. If you have a child that sings and dances down the halls at home, maybe a STEM-heavy school isn't the right fit for that child. So I think the reforms that we are needing now lean towards teaching children in the style that is going to help them best learn.
When you mentioned the pandemic, before we get back to these broad reforms that you're talking about, and the 21st century schools, innovation schools, public charters, and the like, I've got to ask you, I mean, when I read what has gone on throughout the course of the pandemic, you referenced something that I think is a positive during all this, that parents really got to look in on the educational process. But what I've been reading is that kids have fallen so far behind, particularly those already impinged upon by many socioeconomic factors, that they've lost, I don't know, what is it, 8 months, 10 months, maybe up to 2 years worth of schooling, many disenrolled during the process. What did you see while you've been working at the Progressive Policy Institute looking at reinventing schools? How much did you all have to stop in your tracks and say, wow, what does this do to all that we're talking about?
Yes, we really did stop in our tracks, and I think that's probably the same for every research organization that works in this space. It was just stunning to think about hundreds of thousands, millions of children kept out of the classroom and not able to progress with their socialization and their education. It was just such a terrible, terrible thing that happened. Address your question about learning loss. Of course, we know that it's going to be children who were already behind, most likely children of color, children in lower economic circumstances. And we really are advocating for school districts to provide the extra tutoring that is needed and ongoing benchmarking to see how far children are behind so that they can get the appropriate interventions. It's really quite frightening when you think about a whole generation perhaps never realizing their potential because of this blip that was so disruptive. On the other hand, we look at it as a period of opportunity. Because families and parents were really forced by this to become more engaged in their children's education, we at the Progressive Policy Institute, Reinventing America's Schools, are making a concerted effort to amplify their voices and hoping that policymakers and educational leaders can understand that this is a time for change. I mentioned earlier that if we were creating an education system from scratch, it would not look like our education in the United States does now. It's much harder to reform and change a system, but sometimes periods of great disruption can lead to change. We saw that in New Orleans after the terrible Hurricane Katrina, which just decimated that city in 2005. Leaders in that city and in that state took that as an opportunity to really toss out the old education system, which had been called one of the worst public school systems in the country, and reinvent it. And they did that, taking all of the schools except for 17 of them and chartering them. And the reason that they did that was because after the hurricane, the city first, and then secondly, the state, after the state stepped in, they were unable to get their act together, so to speak, and get the public school system in New Orleans reopened. So instead, they brought in leaders who selected charter schools to run those schools. And today, the New Orleans school system is vastly, vastly improved from where it was nearly 20 years ago. And for a time, it was the fastest growing public school system. And by growing, I mean improving academic outcomes, whether through test scores or attendance, graduation, all of these different measures that are used to sort of give a snapshot of how well an education system is performing for its students.
Now, I want to back up because this whole idea of charter schools, I know my perspective is from the state in which I live. And I recall lots of debate. Well, it's great for a small number of kids, even within Hartford or Bridgeport, some of the poorest communities in the state of Connecticut. The few kids who can get into those public charter schools do very well. We had one that was sending kids who were very impoverished off to incredible institutions of higher learning and such. But the idea was, but that's just for a few kids. We can't really do that for all of the children. Therefore, we're doing something that is invidiously discriminating against those kids left behind in neighborhood schools. So I guess my question is, what has happened? Because the Republicans for a period of time were talking about vouchers and allowing kids to go to public, private, parochial schools. And the Democrats, because of the teachers' unions perhaps, were tethered to the conventional model that you're saying we need to push away from. So where is the constituency for public charter schools?
So at first I want to make sure that your audience understands what a charter school is, because surprisingly, when surveys are taken, even though charter schools just marked their 30th anniversary this year of the first charter school law, and next fall will mark the opening of the first charter school, which was in Minnesota, many people really don't understand what a charter school is. So I just want to take a minute.
Yeah.
A charter school is a public school that is funded with public dollars. And in this country, the way we fund education is, it's called per pupil funding. The money follows the child as long as that child is in a public school, meaning not a parochial school or some other kind of private school. The difference between a charter school and a public school is that it is not governed by the school district in which it sits. So if it's a charter school in Hartford or Bridgeport, as you mentioned, it would not be governed by the Bridgeport Public Schools. It is governed by its own board of directors or board of trustees. It must comply with all federal and state laws, such as like no discrimination based on race, health codes, and the like. But other than that, it is free to design its curriculum. So you may get a school that is focused on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEAM, science, technology, engineering, art, and math, or you may have an arts-focused school, or a school that perhaps is girls only to remove the distraction, or a Montessori type model. There's so many different models of schools. And so parents can choose to send their child to this school. Unfortunately, as you alluded to, what happens is because there's not enough of them, is there are usually long waiting lists. And so these schools resort to a lottery. Parents apply and randomly the applications are chosen until the school is filled. In New York City, there are tens of thousands of children on the waiting list for a charter school because the state legislature in New York has capped arbitrarily the number of charter schools that can open in New York City. They just created a brand new nursing high school just this past week or so. And it is in direct response to the nursing shortage brought upon by the coronavirus pandemic. And so they wanted to create this high school where students would earn credits toward a nursing degree at the same time they're working towards their high school diploma. They wanted to open it in New York City. New York City was the epicenter for a time of the coronavirus and is a magnet for medical professionals, but because of this cap, they were forced to open it in Albany, New York, hours away from New York City. So yes, there are usually not enough seats to go around, but that is a product of parents recognizing that public school systems with their top-heavy bureaucracies are just ill-suited to meet the needs of today's kids. It would be great if there were enough to go around. It would be great if more superintendents were willing to relinquish some control over their schools and let them innovate, which is what charter schools were created to do. But until we evolve and reform, it is better to create as many as we legally can and allow as many children that opportunity as possible, while at the same time advocating for public school systems to do better. And because charter schools compete with the district in which they're geographically located, there have been studies that have proven that charter schools creating competition for district schools has improved performance and outcomes for kids who are still in the traditional school system as well. That's my long answer, but I will go on to say that you asked specifically about the constituency. Charter schools were actually conceived of initially by Democrats and union leaders. Albert Schenker, who was a famous union leader, teachers union leader for many years, was one of the thought leaders on the early charter schools. For many years, charter schools enjoyed bipartisan support. Bill Clinton supported them. George Bush, W. Bush supported them. Barack Obama supported them. So they really have only become a super political, hyper controversial issue as the teachers' unions really have amped up their fight against them.
Okay, now let me back up here, because I've got to ask, are the teachers' unions transferable? In other words, those who are teaching within the charter schools, I'm trying to figure out why they perform so much better, aside from, say, uber governmental structures in terms of a district and such. In other words, is it because the teachers self-select they want to be there? Is it that the kids are more motivated because the parents really want them there because they see that this is the kind of specialized place that their child needs and they watch over them even more carefully? Is it because there's more funding that goes to the charter schools? I think you said earlier, and I think I've read, where no, they get about the same amount per child. Well, so what's the difference?
I think it's a combination of everything that you mentioned. I'm actually working on a project right now. I went to Indianapolis to interview teachers who are teaching in innovation schools, which are slightly different than charter schools, and we can get into that. Why would they give up union protections, guaranteed step increased pay raises, the right to grievance procedures if they're disciplined for some reason? And I think it is the joy of teaching. I think if you ask any teacher, and I total disclaimer here, I'm not a teacher. I've never been a teacher. I don't pretend to know what's in teachers' heads, but I've talked to hundreds of teachers throughout my career. And I think the main complaint that teachers have is that they feel constrained. They're not allowed to teach the way they want to teach. They need to be on page 372 of the textbook by the winter break. They need to squeeze in this many different kind of math skills by the end of the school year. And sometimes their kids just aren't on pace to learn at the rate that they're supposed to go. They disagree with the amount of testing, many, many things. But I think teachers really want the freedom to connect with their students and teach from the heart. And I think charter school teachers feel that the trade-off of the autonomy to have more decision-making in the charter school or to have a direct line to the decision-makers because the decision-maker is their principal rather than a bureaucrat, you know, distant central office, I think they feel that they can be heard and respected. And on the other side of the coin, charter schools tend to treat their teachers pretty well because they don't want to lose them. They know that the teachers could go, perhaps make more money, have more union protections in a traditional school. So I think there's a nice symbiotic relationship there. And I think parents don't really care whether it's a charter school or a traditional school. They just want to know that their student is getting the best education possible, and they will vote with their feet if their child is not, if they have a choice. And
okay,
not
so
all parents
these
do.
Teachers are not part, even though they're public school teachers just within a charter, they're not part of the union that governs the neighborhood schools.
That is correct, and that is why the unions are so opposed to charter schools, because every teacher that takes a job at a charter school is a dues-paying member that they lose. Now, that said, charter schools do have the right to unionize and to form their own collective bargaining bloc. that has happened in some places. There are several charter schools in Chicago that have unionized. Many have not. The vast majority have not. And I can't speak to why that is, but clearly they don't feel that they need another layer of rules and constraints about how long the school day can be, how long the school year can be, how many minutes they get to teach or have to teach, because we've just seen over 30 years that very few of these charter schools have unionized.
So we look back at the old industrial model that John Dewey established back in the late 19th century, and we know what that was meant to do, churn people out for very rote jobs. Today, of course, in this new economy, it's so hard to keep up in any profession, and teaching has got to feel the same impingement. And I've got to believe now that we've incorporated technology into the process, can we ever really remove it? Do we want to remove it? Because now it's become part of a hybrid system in many ways, where there will be no school days in the North because we've got the ability to reach kids at home and such. So there are so many moving parts going on. Yet one of the moving parts that I would think, given what I know about the educational system in this country, is it's going to take a long time, Tressa, for us to get all these kids into charters, to devolve these school systems into something that looks like a 21st century school, which involves, according to David Osborne's writings, and I know you ascribe to a lot of them, school-level autonomy, accountability for results, diversity of school designs, public school choice, competition between schools. I mean, that all sounds really provocative and great that we're really there fighting for these kids, but it's going to take a long time. What do we do in the meantime?
I think in the meantime, school districts need to pour on the professional development in technology. And by that, I mean, you're right, you're going to have snow days in the North. Hopefully the climate hasn't warmed enough that you will still have snow days. And there will be times that, you know, kids cannot go to school, maybe in California because of fires or in Louisiana because of flooding. We know that natural disasters happen. We know that weather happens. And we know that, unfortunately, this may not be our last pandemic. So what I would suggest is that every school district in this country get their teachers as well trained as possible to teach remotely. And by that, I don't mean how do you work Zoom. There are whole schools of best practices on how to keep kids engaged remotely, you know, and I don't know them, but I've spoken with professors who teach these in teachers' colleges. And there are a real definite skill set for teaching online and teaching remotely. And I think that we are going to just have to accept as a society that from time to time, kids may not be in the classroom. And for some kids, that works okay. Others, it's more challenging, especially in the special education arena. And I think we're probably going to have to adjust our thinking on how much money we spend on education, because it will be more expensive to do it this way in some cases. But I think as a society, we have to keep up. You know, there was a big report that was a seminal report in 1983 called A Nation at Risk, and it analyzed where we were compared to other countries. And we haven't really fixed that problem. If you look at the PISA, the international scores, we're behind countries like Czechoslovakia and Slovenia, and it's not just Asia. We really have a lot of work to do to catch up at this point.
If the whole idea is personalization, that we need to meet the kids where they are and help them move into areas perhaps more quickly, as you talked about the nursing directed school. I know that in my home city of Waterbury, Connecticut, they now have a high school that's called a career academy that gets people ready for allied health and other services where they can jump right into a job. I know that President Biden's been talking about the ability to get a lot of people without a college degree a lot more education that is really practical and functional early on. But it just seems like a lot of that will be a whole lot more expensive than one size fits all.
Yeah, probably, but there are creative ways around it. There is an organization that incubates charter schools out of Stockton, California. And for your Connecticut listeners, Stockton is a very poor city, and it sits at the north end of California's vast central valley, where many of our oranges and avocados and grapes and pistachios come from. They have just partnered with a local community college that's heavy on agriculture to create a charter high school actually sitting on the campus of this community college. And it is an agriculture program that is intended to funnel students from, they will graduate with an AA degree in crop science or dairy farming or any of the highly technical agriculture fields. And then they will be eligible to transfer right in to like a San Luis Obispo, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, which is an agricultural college, or Kansas University, or any of the big agricultural schools. So that is addressing a local need in a very cost-effective way by partnering with this community college. This same organization is also partnering with the San Joaquin County Office of Education in California. It's so large, they've organized the state into county offices of education that are the conduit between local school districts and the state. And they are creating a teacher's high school, a charter teacher's high school that will meet, when they go back to meeting in person, physically in the county offices of education. It is addressing a very specific need, which is a chronic teacher shortage in the Stockton area. And it is drawing students who already know that they have an affinity for wanting to become a teacher. So I think as we go, we need to be more creative in the public-private partnerships. I'll give you one other. In Indianapolis, Purdue University, which is the premier university, especially in the medical and technical fields in Indiana, was distressed that over a period of, I don't want to be specific, but maybe it was 6 or 7 years, only 36 graduates from the Indianapolis public schools who were African American qualified for entrance to Purdue. And Purdue felt that was really inequitable. So they have partnered with a charter organization to create an innovative high school that is completely project-based. And it's crazy innovative. The students choose from a portfolio of projects. They work in teams. And the project might be extending a healthy human life cycle or something like that. And they can come at the project from many different directions. And when they get to something where they're stumped, they schedule a class with a teacher, whether it's a math teacher or a social sciences teacher. And those kids, when they graduate, are guaranteed admission and financial help to go to Purdue University. So I think we're going to be seeing, and we're going to need to see, more partnering with schools to deliver the services that today's job market requires, and to meet students where they're at in terms of their interests and their abilities and their affinities, if we're going to be successful. That's what
we need to do. How urgent do people understand this issue to be? Because a quarter of those who apply to the U.S. Army fail admissions tests. We've done podcasts on this. Lots of kids just, they cannot meet their recruitment goals, and a lot of it is academic aptitude. We've got more than a third of those who are going on to college, not prepared for the first year college, and they're taking remedial courses at community colleges. Almost half of them never graduate. And then we rank 22nd on high school graduation. We're in the bottom half in math, science, and reading proficiency. And I was reading that David Osborne, in his introduction to his book, Reinventing America's Schools, said today our traditional public schools work for less than half of our students. I mean, when do we declare this a national emergency?
Right now, truly right now. It it's the thing that keeps me up at night. It's very frustrating that it isn't being shouted from the rooftops. It's very frustrating that it's never discussed. You know, we have 24-hour cable news stations that repeat the same story over and over and over until we're so sick of it, we just turn off the television. But they don't seem to be able to carve out 5 or 10 minutes to have somebody like David Osborne come on and, you know, raise the red flag. I don't know what the answer is. I write op-eds, I write research papers, and I have a hard time getting attention to them. And I don't want the attention for myself. I want the attention for the issue. And I tear my hair out over it. I think it is the civil rights issue of our time, because the people that are being the furthest left behind are Black and brown kids. But I think it is critical for all of us. I have nieces and nephews that I see just could care less pretty much about their education because they had such a bad experience in elementary school that by the time they got to high school, they were just kind of tuned out, going through the motions just to get through the day. It worries me. It really does. On the other hand, there are huge beacons of hope. I visited 6 innovation schools in Fort Worth, Texas, this past summer, right before school let out. And these are schools that are being done in partnership with Texas Wesleyan University and the Fort Worth Independent School District. And the woman running those schools, Priscilla Dilley, was just awe-inspiring. And every teacher that she had was 110%. They have a data-driven system where a lesson is given, and then the kids take a short quiz on the material just taught, and they're given either red, yellow, or green based on how much they retain, and the principal tracks that on a daily basis, and they circle back, and the kids in the yellow and red are given a remedial lesson almost on the spot. It's a mastery form of learning where kids are not moved on to the next lesson until they master the preceding lesson. And it was a 6 schools full of life and energy and passion. And so that's what keeps me going, is seeing places like that where they're innovating and using data. But overall, I tend to feel a little pessimistic.
Well, when we do look at how fast the world is changing, what technology is doing, the way kids are stimulated outside of a school, inside that school, they've got to deal with what's going on outside. They've got to internalize the best of what these new devices can provide in terms of learning instruments, shortcut those things that now you can use those devices for, and really get at the critical thinking and some of the other aspects of teaching that you can't put into any box, that has to still be interactive between a teacher and a student. But figuring all of that out is so tremendously difficult. And yet, as you say, we're up against it. We've just lost kids for a while, many of whom we may not get back for some time, or when we do get them back, it's going to be at a critical loss that they have suffered. So it's really an important issue. And I'm so glad that the Progressive Policy Institute has you and others working on this. Tressa Pankovitz, can you leave us with a thought as to how we here in local communities can begin to push some of the new ideas that you're seeing happening around the country?
Sure, and thank you so much for having me. I would just encourage listeners to open up their minds and learn a little bit more about autonomous schools, and not to be afraid of thinking outside the bureaucracy. I know centralized bureaucratic school districts are the way that we've always done it. Just because we've always done it that way doesn't mean that it isn't time for change. And I think that we need to amplify parents' voices as much as possible. Every parent wants their kid to do better than they did. And I think listening to parents and trying to become involved in encouraging the decision makers to listen to parents and to become a little bit more fluid is the best thing that we can do.
It's very interesting that I have watched what I call the superintendent carousel go round and round. When I was on radio, I used to interview a new superintendent in the city from which I was broadcasting, and they'd all come in with these incredibly interesting reform plans. And then by the time they were, you know, really to actualize them, they would have left to move on to a larger district. I think in many industries, and I'm going to call education an industry, this is what goes on. The adults, whether it's college sports, or whether it's whatever else you might want to consider, they look at their own needs and not those of the students as much. And they play a game to stay in this, you know, carousel or on this carousel for as long as they can, because it benefits them and perhaps not the kids.
I think that can be true of some superintendents, and I think it's human nature to seek career advancement. No minor league baseball player wants to spend his whole career in double A. But on the other hand, I will say that there are some really dysfunctional school boards out there. And you mentioned Bridgeport. Bridgeport had a tremendously dysfunctional school board for many, many years, to the point where the state attempted to take over the district. During that period of time, they brought in an excellent superintendent that Bridgeport was very fortunate to have because of its size. This was a superintendent who had managed districts of hundreds of thousands of children, and Bridgeport had about 23,000 at the time. And the board made his life so hard that he left, and he didn't leave for a bigger district. He just couldn't take it anymore. And I think that if more people take this education issue seriously, and now that we're doing things on Zoom some of the time, maybe tune in to a school board meeting, show up at a school board meeting. They're usually only once a month and maybe twice, and hear what's going on and hold these boards accountable. I think if you have better, stronger school boards, you'll have better, stronger schools.
In closing, I know that I have to do more research on public charters. I think I lost step with where they are and these innovation school ideas. Through the PPI, the Progressive Policy Institute, how can we get more information so that we're armed when we, not armed in the way that some are going to these school board meetings, but with information, how can we do that?
Well, the Progressive Policy Institute can be found at www.progressivepolicy.org. And on that website, there's a tab that says projects, and that's a drop down. If you click on Reinventing America's Schools, everything that we have written is there, and including an abridged version of our founder David Osborne's book, and also including a long report we did last year on innovation schools, and I promise it's not as boring as it sounds. And at the end of that report, it is also is included as model legislation for anybody who might want to think about doing this in another state that doesn't have innovation schools. Credo, I mentioned, which is a Center for Research on Educational Outcomes at Stanford University. You could just Google Credo Education, and you'll find a vast amount of research and reports there. And again, I know this sounds boring, but it's really, really important that people get involved. And once you get into it a little bit, it's really not boring at all. It's the future of our nation and our society.
Absolutely. And get on it as quickly as you can. And if you have a child, even faster. Tressa Pankovitz, I thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.